Andy Scheckman, president of Miles Franklin Limited. That's your go-to place for numismatics and gold bullion. Welcome back, Andy Scheckman.
Hey, thanks, Chris. It's always great to be with you.
Yeah, it's really good to have you back. And speaking of being back from the World Series, Game 1, Boston, of course, nearly swept the series. Give us an idea on the World Championship game and what you thought of Game 1.
Well, you know, I'm a baseball fanatic, have been my entire life. It probably meant more to me than just about anything outside of family my entire life. Fenway was always on the bucket list, and Bill Holter and I sat just a few rows away from the Green Monster. And if it weren't for the fact that it was 40 degrees and raining prior to the game, so I was wet and cold, I don't think anything could have detracted from it. It's an amazing experience to be in a place like Fenway, a place where, you know, so many of the greats have played. I will say this, though, I'll tell you, it's not an inexpensive endeavor to go see a World Series game. You're talking to sit in left field in the corner. You're talking $1,200 a ticket, cheapest you can find anywhere. So it was kind of those once in a life bucket list type of deals that we were excited to do. And,
that's not just walking around money. That's one single gold eagle to sit in those seats.
Makes you think about it. It really does. And it makes you think strongly about it, as a matter of fact, and if it's even sustainable going forward for a sporting event.
What I didn't ask you was who you were rooting for.
I'm an American League diehard. I have to go with Boston, absolutely. Being in Minnesota and Minnesota Twins fan, you got to stick with the Americans.
Well, that certainly worked out well for you then this year with, of course, Boston clinching the world championship.
But I'll tell you, they're a heck of a squad and a heck of a team. And, you know, there's no question that in baseball, money can certainly buy you a championship. They were a fun team to watch all year long. It's one of those deals where it just seems every year those teams like the Red Sox and the Yankees find their way to the very end, and this is one of the years where they were able to finish it.
There's an interesting story around the Red Sox. For folks into quantitative mathematics, the owner, at least for about a decade at least, he was using statistical and computer modeling, sabermetrics, to set up the best players at any given time on the field for his team, and it actually had paid dividends.
Baseball is a game of statistics and law of average.
I think really when you run the numbers, you know, you run the regression analysis, you start to see statistics pop up.
I'll say one last thing about it. The more you look at the world, the more you'll find mathematics come into play. Whether it be business or sports, mathematics finds its way into the discussion. And I think you can certainly find that in baseball. And it was awesome to be there. It was even better to be there with Bill Holter. And I appreciate you bringing that up. So
over to the markets, you know, interesting week. Last week, we saw the yellow metal move up along with the U.S. dollar. We don't typically see this. I'd like to get your take on the fact that we've got this surprisingly hawkish Fed, their forward guidance. People aren't terribly pleased. Investors aren't really excited about the idea of another year of higher rates. At this point, it really seems to me like it's baked into the market. I mean, investors have a solid feel for what's coming. They're not terribly even interested in what the Fed has to say. And we also see central bankers around the world, you know, the ECB ministers, economic ministers getting really hawkish in their rhetoric, China and Japan as well. Give us an idea on what you see on a forward basis here.
To me, if we're talking forward basis as it relates to precious metals, I could tell you that in all the years I've been doing this, Chris, I don't know that I've ever been more optimistic ultimately, just based upon the positioning of the commercial bank traders. And I think that when you take a look at things like interest rates and forward guidance, it certainly is very, very important. There's no question about it. I'm not underplaying that. But to me, the ultimate guidance of the market in precious metals is directed by the most sophisticated, well-funded, well-informed, influential traders on the globe, and that's the commercial banks. And I think that you can throw all the other things out the window, because if you look at the last decade, there has been a discorrelation between logic and outcome, and you can throw every single logical argument out there as to why metals should have and should be climbing and going to the through the roof, and yet there has been nothing but disappointment and hair pulling when you try to figure out why it hasn't. And when you take, I don't think you need to really look any further than the positioning of the commercial banks. They have been short for the last 50 years. They've been continually short in the precious metals market, other than about three occasions, this being the third. Right now, for the first time that I can remember, really, in forever, and it is only the third time, I believe, in the last 50 years, the commercial banks have turned bullish on paper in the futures market. You have a conglomerate of traders who, for the very first time, I think, have pulled off almost a coup, a short squeeze, if you will, is brewing, and they've hoodwinked technical traders into creating the largest short position the COMEX market has ever seen. So you have the most sophisticated traders on the globe going long on paper, but then you don't have to look any further than the positioning of JP Morgan in their physical market, amassing 800 million ounces of physical silver in their house account, which is eight times what the Hunt brothers tried to corner. It's the largest physical position of silver the world's ever seen at one time, and many, many tens of thousands of ounces of gold. All told, their physical exposure right now is over $50 billion in physicals. And if you go back over the last decade, Chris, you can see very easily that J.P. Morgan, who has been the chief shorter in the market, has not needed the physicals in order to control the price. Perhaps they've been controlling the price in order to accumulate this mammoth, largest physical position the world has ever seen, a physical metal in their house account. So I think when we talk about forward guidance, we can take all the technicals and look at them and appreciate them and understand them, but I don't think you look any further than the positioning of JP Morgan and the other commercial banks who, again, for the third time in 50 years are going long on paper on top of a vastly huge physical position they've already amassed.
Take a look at JP Morgan's balance sheets. They were nearly net short around the time of the Great Recession. I think they saw not only an opportunity, but they saw a weakness. They saw a flaw in their business model, and they knew, hey, look, we've got to do something about this. And now, from what I understand, they've amassed what's probably one of the largest, if not the largest, stockpiles of silver in the world. But, you know, here's an interesting anecdote. Precious metals aficionados might be interested to know. Putin over in Russia is actually the Moscow central bank there. They're actually accumulating and have been accumulating silver now for the first time in decades, along with their gold stockpile. So it's not just J.P. Morgan and Andy Schechtman and Gold Seek Radio that sees the opportunity there. We've had a lot of not so positive comments here on silver relative to gold. People are concerned that during this big run in gold they're expecting, silver might not participate this time. Some of our experts are less excited on the prospects of silver. That hasn't been the case, as far as history shows us, in the last two big bull markets.
In fact, if you go back to the beginning of time, there's about a 90% correlation in the movement between gold and silver throughout all of time. There are times when one will outperform the other or move without participation of the other, but in general, the magneticism between the two will pull them along. And if we talk about the gold to silver relationship, if someone asked me right now, Chris, what is the best thing I could do right now with my gold and silver portfolio, but I don't want to spend any money, the answer is trading gold for silver. In fact, if you look at over the last 50 years, there's been one brief time in 1993 where that ratio of gold to silver, which is currently about 84 or 85 to 1, was more advantageous. In other words, for those people who aren't quite familiar with the gold to silver ratio, it's just as simple as how many ounces of silver does it take to buy an ounce of gold. Geologically, it's 15.5 times more abundant silver is than gold in the Earth's crust. And probably that's why we have that 16 to 1 ratio that goes back thousands of years. But if you go back 50 years, there's been one time in the last 50 years, in 1993, where you could get more silver for trading your gold. And, you know, I think if you take a look at the average ratio between the two over the last five decades has been roughly 45 to 1. at 85-1 right now, and that's probably why you got a lot of people saying that, because it has so vastly underperformed. But you take a step back, it's so vastly underperformed, yet J.P. Morgan has amassed 800 million ounces of it in their house account and now is going long on paper. They have used these suppressed prices, the misdirection, if you will, to accumulate the silver, and it frustrates technical analysts who say silver's dead because they look at the technicals. This is called painting the tape. This is called misdirection. This is called getting everyone to look one way while you rob or pillage the physical stockpile and create the largest position in the world. But if you take a look at the opportunity that they have created for us through this misdirection, the anomaly that they have created is a once-in-a-five-decade opportunity to trade gold for silver at 85-1. And if nothing else happens but that gold were to fall back to, the gold-silver ratio fall back to its five-decade mean or average, you double the amount of gold you started with by trading back into gold. Playing these ratios is vastly important. And I guess I would simply say this, Chris. I would bet my life that one will not go to the moon without the other. But I take a lot of solace in the fact that J.P. Morgan may be maniacal, but they're very sophisticated, and they are very influential, and they are very well-informed, and they have deep pockets. And to amass 800 million ounces, eight times what the Hunt brothers tried to acquire in 1980, the largest position the world's ever seen, is significant. They believe the price is going higher, and I think you don't do what they say, you do what they do. Forget about technical analysis. That is the biggest flaw in the argument, is that people are following technical analysis, and the people who are pulling the strings understand that. And if all you do is manipulate the price below moving averages and technical indicators, it gives you the ability to acquire the lion's share of the physicals without competition, to misdirect the public away from and the technical traders away from acquiring silver, so that they have the ability to hand over fist, gobble up as much as they want without gaining attention or upsetting the apple cart, if you will.
I mean, I think we'd probably differ somewhat with technical analysis. I mean, obviously, it gives up, you know, if you're a trend follower, fantastic long and short signals. Where investors are confused today is that they've seen, you know, these markets in the doldrums for so long because we have so many money managers and fund managers and institutions and big players who do ride the trends, okay? The themes, and it tends to overshoot on the upside and the downside, and we've certainly seen it on the downside, unfortunately, in our favorite sector. But there's another key change here that I don't know that almost anyone will remember, and that is that we have been in the middle of a secular bull market in bonds, you know, since the end of the last major gold bull market around 1980, arguably even before. And that looks like it may finally, the widowmaker, they call it, be coming to an end now. And if that's the case, you want to talk about an unbelievable potential of influx of funds from non-traditional sources looking for a safe haven. But do you think bond investors, they're not going to be looking for U.S. equities at all-time record highs. They're not going to be interested in the typical investment. They want safety. You can see it right now. They're running to the short end on the U.S. T-bill and T-notes. They're searching for security. What happens when that loses its appeal? There's nowhere to go to. There is no safe haven left but the precious metals.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you could argue that the bond market is the mother of all bubbles, no question about it. And it has kind of appears to have perhaps be on the cusp of running its course. But I do have a hard time believing that they'll let interest rates get out of hand. If you see interest rates move up as to the degree that perhaps some believe they will, it will be perhaps the beginning of the greatest depression of all time. And when you have a $22 trillion debt and $145 trillion in unfunded liabilities, letting interest rates get out of hand is really the beginning of the end. And, you know, people don't quite grasp how big the problem really is, the indebtedness that we have and the alternatives. A trillion seconds ago was 31,688 years ago. The numbers have become big, but you're right. Where are the alternatives? Where do you run if you ultimately seek safety? Certainly it's not in the equity markets that are trading at record price-to-earnings ratios and paying virtually nothing in terms of a dividend. And when you talk about where people go, I don't know. I think it's currencies certainly aren't the the answer. So yeah, it's to the 6,000-year-old history of precious metals, and maybe something like our new program, the Tradewind program that we have launched in conjunction with Sprott and Goldcorp, the program at the Royal Canadian Mint that allows no storage fees, no management fees, where gold is held with custody denoted on a distributed ledger and held at the Royal Canadian Mint. So you get someone who comes in with a $100 million bond portfolio wanting to buy gold. It's not outlandish for us to be able to place that on the distributed ledger with the Royal Canadian Mint with no storage or management fees. Market is perhaps getting ready for that type of a situation with all of these new blockchain-based gold programs that will allow for large acquisitions without the typical problems associated with logistics, storage, transportation, etc. Our program with the Royal Canadian Mint, I believe, has addressed that. So we're ready if that happens, Chris, and certainly wouldn't surprise me. The markets have kind of defied gravity and logic for a very, very long time. It would make sense I think bottom line is if you go back over the last 30, 40 years, the manipulation, if you will, has not been in the precious metals market. The manipulation has been in the interest rate market. And there's an inverse relationship called Gibson's paradox between interest rates and precious metals. And if you have really low interest rates, which creates a perception of wealth, an illusion of wealth, and things like our 401ks and our homes with easy money and low interest rates, everything levitates. But Gibson's paradox says you have to hold down the price of gold because it's an inverse relationship between real interest rates and gold. So they've got themselves kind of in a little bit of a quandary over the years. And so when this all unwinds, when it does unwind, I think, yeah, absolutely, gold will probably be the last man standing and, of course, silver, because there are so few alternatives in a world that has seen valuations across the board get so out of whack.
But you know, there's a subtle nuance we should put on Gibson's paradox. You briefly touched on it. The key takeaway is real interest rates. In other words, you know, not this phony baloney nominal number that we see tossed around. When we bring inflation into play, the real, the true, that we all have to pay at the pump.
The $70,000 a year college tuition to the University of Michigan I'm paying right now. There is inflation, and it's just hidden in places that are things that we need, not things that we want, like color TVs and cell phones, which are really, you know, cheap and affordable for everyone to afford, but things like health care, things like energy, things like college tuition, things like insurance. Those things are inflating, and when the real inflation hits the system, when it leaves the financial system and falls into the real economy, yeah, I think people will understand very quickly why they've owned precious metals all these years. But it's also important to note one thing, too, Chris. While a lot of us claim to be inflationists, there are some people who would believe that this will be the greatest deflation ever seen, guys like Harry Dent. But I'll simply say this, I don't agree with him. But I will say that gold has proven perhaps to be the finest store of value in a deflation as well, because it is the only asset, one of the.
It protects your purchasing.
It does, because it's not someone else's, simultaneously someone else. So whether we see inflation or deflation, for people not to have an allocation to gold and silver right now, when the handwriting is so clearly on the wall that something's going down, whether it be inflation, deflation, currency collapse, market collapse, whatever it may be, you must have an allocation to gold.
Let's insert a few others there. A global trade war. Tariffs like we haven't seen since Smoot Hawley and the Great Depression. For the everyday listener, we could possibly be switching to the risk off. And when I say risk off, I mean priced to perfection, as they call it on Wall Street, world, to the even slightly risk on a 10-watt bulb. I mean, heaven help us if we go to a risk full-on floodlight scenario, which, by the way, can happen at any time. Time, especially given now that folks are no longer buying like mad to front run the trade tariffs, and now the hangover from the big party could be upon us. This really could be a risk on environment, in which case bonds, where's the appeal there? We have higher interest rates. We have the threat of rates going up. People don't want to buy bonds. They're certainly going to be terrified of U.S. stocks, which were priced, as I said, to perfection before. So there's really very few go-to assets. And then add to all the leverage that's been, you know, just thrown on top. The return to the mean. Didn't we start off the show today with the thought of financial mathematics? The return to the mean on the upside really could be maybe a 2 or 3 standard deviation event. event.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, look, when you have created market anomalies and distortions to the greatest magnitude ever seen, stock markets trading at levels never seen before. Look, people wouldn't have ever dreamed of buying stocks way back when unless they were trading at single-digit price-to-earnings ratios while paying a handsome dividend. When you push interest rates so far below what they really should be, when you manipulate all of the numbers to the degree that they have been to create perception of reality, that is, perception of wealth, an illusion of wealth, when these numbers have been massaged to the level that they have, when things correct, yes, it will be something to behold. No question about it, Chris. And I think one of the knocks against people in my industry is the doom and gloom scenario, and people always talking about the worst is yet to come. But, you know, look, even in the best of times, people should have a 10% allocation of precious metals to their portfolio. And if you can honestly sit back and think that these are anywhere near the best times, that the things that we've just touched on don't have at least a 10 or a 20% chance of happening, then you ought to at least have a commensurate position in gold and silver to your portfolio, a 10 or 20%. Quite frankly, if I were being honest, if I had a gun to my head, I would say you're going to not have a far more substantial allocation to gold and silver, and I try to be as objective as possible. If I truly felt that gold and silver were on their way out, I would tell my clients to sell and I'd find a new profession. I sleep very, very well at night, Chris, making the recommendations I do. I believe in my heart that gold and silver will have their day in the sun, and you don't have to look any further than the positioning of the most sophisticated traders on the globe, and all of the big central banks are accumulating it hand over fist right now.
You know, we have J.P. Morgan, which has arguably the ear in a direct, you might say the bat phone, right? I mean, a direct line, the Federal Reserve. They are directly in line. They know what's coming down the pike. Do you think they're taking physical delivery of crude oil and wheat and grain and pork bellies? No, they're stockpiling the stuff in their basement in New York. But there's another, I think, important point you made that I'd like to highlight, underscore, and embolden, that there are times when the 10, 15, 20% recommended, you know, the boring precious metals allocation. No institution out there, no pension institutions with the deep pockets has even half a percentage point, probably less than half of a percentage point. And that's according to our good friends up at BMG in Canada, Nick Barishev. They don't have even half a percentage of their trillions of dollars, $4 trillion, by the way, in just Tokyo alone, invested in the precious metals. Can you imagine the tsunami of funds just waiting on the sidelines, on the benches, that's going to pour into this game by the time it's over?
If that happened, which, you know, if 1% of that money flew into the gold market, you'd see prices going through the roof overnight. But what you'd really see is what we saw for the most part the last decade, save the last 2 years, from roughly 2006 or 7 through 2014 or 15, the biggest challenge that we faced was securing product. Now, we're one of only 27 companies ever approved by the U.S. Mint to resell their product as an authorized reseller. We're high up on the totem pole with all the major sovereign mints, Austrian, Australian, Canadian, South African. I know all of the big players in the industry. And most of my public speaking over the last decade centered around the inability to adequately source product at a period of time when most people wouldn't know gold coin if it fell on their foot. And I do really think that it's important to note that the supply chain in the physical market is pretty much controlled by five mints: U.S., Canada, South Africa, Australia, and Austria. Now, you have the Great Britain Mint and the New Zealand Mint and the Chinese Mint. Well, all of those together really don't amount to much of anything. And you have some private refineries. But when those five mints run into problem, or any of them run into problem, as we saw in 2008 when they all ran out of product simultaneously and premiums went to the moon, the biggest problem people will face will not be in escalating prices. It will be in finding anything worthwhile to actually physically own. The time to buy precious metals, or the time to buy anything, is when they're out of favor. And precious metals, let's just be honest, they've been out of favor for quite some time. You can lament that and cry about it, or you can look at it as a subsidy. As a subsidy, when a group like J.P. Morgan, who in the last decade has never had one losing, the very fact that they're now accumulating hand over fist this amount of physical should tell you they don't need the physical to make billions and billions and billions of dollars manipulating the paper price. Perhaps they're manipulating the paper price to accumulate the physical. And so the bottom line to me, Chris, is that now is the time to be considering adding to your portfolio or adjusting it from gold to silver. If you own palladium, you trade it to platinum. The distortions that we're seeing in the marketplace are creating tremendous opportunities to trade, to swap, to move things around, to reposition without spending a penny. Your listeners could call me and say, I have some palladium, I'd like to trade it to platinum. I have some gold, I'd like to trade it to silver. We'd send them boxes, UPS air bills to get it all sent back and send their stuff back. They don't have to spend a penny. There are ways to win this game without spending more money. We'd love to talk to your listeners. I can always be reached at andy@milesfranklin.com. That's my email. Our website is milesfranklin.com. And my personal 800 number is 255-1129. Accessibility is one of my strong points, Chris, and I'd like to offer that to anyone listening. If you'd like a free assessment of your position and how we can help, anyone can feel free to email me or call directly.
Folks there at Miles Franklin have certainly done a great job of repositioning my very humble piggy bank, so I've got to recommend it to our listeners today. They kind of go out of their way to make sure that you get a better than fair deal. So, I mean, you've got the security, the safety, the trust. And, you know, I've been itching to take my five-year-old to a Braves game. It's not the American League, but you can root the opposing team. There'll have to be two seats between us, no $1,200 seats, but open invitation and ticket to Andy Scheckman at a Braves game, Fulton County, buddy.
Well, you know what? If I'm ever down there, I will take that. No question about it. I think an afternoon at a ballpark is one of my favorite ways in the world to spend an afternoon, and certainly with good people, and you and your son would be at the top of that list, Chris. I do very much appreciate it, and of course, if you're ever up this way, up north, I'd like to see a Twins game, the same thing holds true, and I play golf with the cousin of the owner of the team, and so I can always get a good seat when I need one. So I do appreciate being on your show, Chris. I really do, and I'm always available if you need to check in and see what's going on this side of the table, but you do a great job, and we appreciate very much the affiliation with Gold Seek Radio.
Bob Hoy, I know you watch these markets like very few of our top guests.
A theme I was thinking of using in this week's piece was that major financial contractions are so methodical. This one set itself up. What really got me going, Chris, was the peak in December, January. We had that because in October the 4th, a year ago, it was the whole world was going to get bubbled, including the Dow Jones Industrials, and that they would likely peak in the May, in the December-January window when so many terrific speculations have done so. So you take a look then at the NASDAQ comp, and as it was completing its rally in January, the weekly RSI, which is momentum, it got up to 89, which is high. So I look back on the great dot-com bubble that concluded in early 2000, and the NASDAQ comp, it got up to an RSI of 84, not as strong as the New York Stock Exchange comp. So that was a major event. So then we looked for rallies in industrial commodities. We looked for favorable action in the yield curve and in credit spreads out to around June. So we were looking for, we'll call it sunshine, out to around the middle of the year. And yeah, the industrial commodities rallied nicely. Lumber itself had it had a bubble, incredible bubble all on its own. And then these things have gone down.
You know, a big component of the lumber bubble, tariffs on Canada, because it imposed a tax burden on lumber producers on that industry. And you know, it actually bumped up the mean building cost on a new home in the United States substantially.
Oh, yeah, but it's given up. Like, it's, the high was 659 and down it's like 3.
They were front-running the tariffs.
Yeah. Then that was our sunshine to around the middle of the year. And then in August, we thought it would turn to twilight. Well, It also looked like the stock market, the New York stock market wanted to be positive into September, and that was fine with us because important stock market highs in New York in the September period, and that would be 1929 and also the great bubble that concluded in 1873. So having a rise there. Now, the other thing that got interesting on keeping things positive into September, Chris, was that the price of crude oil, as we noted in early September, seems to have gone into an old seasonal pattern where you could have a high late September, early October. I think the high was October the 3rd, and then go down. So this was set for a probable major decline once crude oil gave up, and it did. Now, then just to strictly look at the stock market, you had a high on the New York Stock Exchange advanced decline line. I think it was August 23rd, and it could lead the high, and I think the high on the S&P or something was September 22nd, something, say there. Through the summer, a number of equity guys suddenly getting on to the yield curve. And yes, the yield curve is important, but they were saying that it had to go inverted where you had, say, a week or so with short rates higher than long rates, which is a mark of speculation. There's terrific demand for short-term money when you're leveraged through the system. But we pointed out that in 1937-38, on that recovery, and the yield curve did not invert, it just rolled over. So our conclusion was the change in the credit, in the yield curve and in the credit spreads would be important, and yes, that came in. So then, Chris, the line we used in June was it would be go from sunshine to twilight in August, and then after that, the twilight zone has arrived. So then the next stage is rather than fight it, our advice through the summer was to, for all accounts, to build liquidity. Just said, get liquidity. Again, we'll resort to history, and there have been five great bubbles since the first, the South Sea bubble in 1720. And number five was 1929. And, of course, we had big bubbles with the dot-com in 2000, and then there was a pretty good, that was 2007 was a pretty good bubble. But, you know, Chris, there were a few things missing there where one could call it a classic bubble. So we've been calling this one a classic bubble, similar to those great historical ones. All of those great bubbles, as they occurred in the first one in London and Paris, the London South Sea bubble peaked in June, dithered around the summer, crashed in the fall. Then everyone in Europe, as they occurred in Europe or London, peaked in the May-June window and crashed in the fall. Now, when New York became a big enough market to be important, which was with the 1873 bubble, it set its speculative high in September and then again in 1929.
It must have its roots, at least initially, with the planting and harvesting cycles.
Chris, the demand for cash money early in the season for agriculture, and then the farmers get cash in the autumns. But
bring the holiday season into play.
The earliest documented fall crash, mortgages in the northern cities in Italy, and it's very well by the name of Cipolla, and they had their many mortgages, and then they decided that they were the local regulations were that they couldn't be traded, So then they decided that they could be traded because there was lots of pressures, and then it crashed. And the worst of those panics were in the fall. So that's as early as you can get on a fall crash.
You know, there's been so much said about the negative side, if you will, of finance. And just like so many things in the world, both can be true simultaneously. You can have a necessary evil. Wouldn't you say, though, that at least in the Western world, for the most part, we have used finance to push our economic production curve, if you will, and economic possibility frontier so forward beyond where we were just 50 to 100 years ago that it has been primarily, not always, but primarily a means to a much better socioeconomic ends. What I'm really driving at here is the invisible hand. I'm talking about the market clearing mechanism. I'm also interested in the supply-demand phenomenon that is at the heart of micro and macroeconomics, the key efficiencies that force industries to be more productive, and by being more productive, create greater value, greater economic wealth, and economic profits above normal profits to the benefit of society overall.
I've thought about the great booms quite a bit. What they do is accelerate innovation. You could also have, like Mensch or somebody did, an index of innovations dating back to 1790s or something like that. But at any rate, a long period of very tedious and trying price inflation with consumers' prices going up, interest rates going up, bond prices going down, so the financial side is very well beat up, then that reaches a peak, like in 1920. And then that period where real interest rates start to go up. And then you saw in Japan decades ago, it was, oh, I can't remember the Japanese for it, but it was the very quick.
Yeah, Kaizen.
In the 1920s, the reason for increasing profitability in business was you kept your shelves as bare as you dare.
Just in time.
There's nothing new in the marketplaces. And what we have is a pattern. I'm interested in pattern recognition. And to ask questions about why, you might just as well say, well, I don't like the Earth rotating at 365 days to the year. Why isn't it 370? So let me continue with pattern recognition and what happens in a contraction. This is where, again, we look at where on the great bubbles, the tendency in London was a peak in June, and then when New York became big enough, New York had its peak in September, but all five of the great bubbles suffered liquidity problems in the fall with forced liquidation, such that the last part of September and October were disasters. And then you would get a relief bounce, which it looks like the market could do now, and then you have a final washout in November that sort of clears the market of the last of the unsupportable positions. And then you have some stability. Now, one of the really biggest of those bubbles culminated in 1825, and it didn't clear in London until Christmas and into New Year's, where the liquidity problem finally washed out.
That's because Great Britain had defeated Napoleon. That would have ushered in a decade or two of economic prosperity. And then you also had in the United States, with the help of France, had actually kicked the Redcoats out of Louisiana, which, of course, ended the War of 1812.
Well, one of the things that really helped speculation on that one, Chris, was that in the panic of 1797 in London, when the fear was that Napoleon was going to invade, also there were some tax measures changed, and Britain went off of gold. And then you then had a fabulous expansion of credit because the central bank was had no restrictions. And so then they went back on gold and 1820. But the market had learned to play with credit, and then you had the bubble of 1825, and some of the biggest stocks were mining stocks, Mexican, for example. In a month's time, they sort of went, underwritten at 10 pounds, traded at 50 pounds, and soared to 150. So you had action. Well, hey, the bubble we were in last year was a bubble in miners. That was Bitcoin miners. So anyways, you had a fabulous bubble, and it crashed, and then the typical pattern is for a long contraction. The abuse of the credit markets was so pervasive, so widespread, and so ruinous that it took a couple of decades to finally wash out all of the credit excesses. So I think this is highly probable. You have a fabulous exposure, fabulous confidence that every speculator in any game whatsoever can be levered to a great prosperity. And then you've also got the concept that central banking intervention is successful. Now, some of these bubbles did occur when the senior central bank was on a gold standard. And they were lesser bubbles, but nonetheless, they crashed and you were followed by contraction. So the conclusions from this, Chris, is that you go through a longish 15 years or so, 20 years or so, of rising commodity prices and rising inflation pressures and that. So then people in the markets hoard tangible assets, commodities, all this sort of stuff. Well, then this goes on as like in 1920, when that change in the commodity index on the way up was incredible, and then on the way down it was a horrendous crash. And, for example, on the CPI inflation in 1920, it got up to 22%, where the policy world went crazy in 1980 when the inflation rate got up to 15%. So then that sets up an era of inflation in financial assets, stocks and bonds. And it was 1982 when I really began to take our research, which I'd been selling to big mining people, and then took it to financial institutions. And on a slide presentation, one of the key conclusions was that no matter how much the Fed prints, stocks will outperform commodities. Now, in 1982, that was quite a regular.
Let's just say a two-decade grueling U.S. equities market.
Yep. So anyways, we're now in, then you go in historically where then eventually the public comes into the market, and it got in, which they did till 1929. And then when that speculation and paper fails, and you get the crash, and then you get the contraction, whereby then people decide they're going to hoard cash. And you recall the New Deal in the 1930s under Roosevelt actually was introduced by Hoover.
But you did bring up the 1929 speculative bubble, the crash and contraction. And one thing that's been overlooked up until recently by most analysts, the impact of the Smoot-Hawley trade tariffs, in retrospect, a key component to the froth that led up to the peak. And then, of course, perhaps the severity of the economic fallout that we felt not only in the United States but throughout the Western world. Give us an idea of whether or not you think that the front running by executives to stockpile as much of their key strategic resources as possible ahead of these tariffs. Now that that passed, will we see a similar hangover in U.S. financial markets as we did in 29, 30?
Well, I can't speak to any corporations hoarding things because you're going into a period where everybody hoards cash. But the pattern has been that following great bubbles and the contraction is that each country suffers high unemployment and hardship, and the local politician has to do something about it. So now the tariffs that have been war that's been discussed with Trump is that he was attempting to reduce unfavorable tariffs against the United States, which had existed for some time. But the real tariff war comes with the recession that follows a great bubble. You mentioned Smoot-Hawley, but following the great 1825 bubble, the U.S. came out with a set of tariffs that at the time were called the tariff of abomination. For example, when I mentioned the 1921 crash in commodities, what did the Federal Reserve during the do the 1920s? They were easy, deliberately easy, because they were afraid basic wholesale prices were going to fall. So they were easy, trying to prevent prices falling, and they didn't understand financial manias, of which they then inadvertently fueled. And now, for the last decade, what has the Fed and policy wonks been concerned about? Well, they had to get inflation up to 2% or something awful would happen. So you were into a period where commodities weren't going anywhere, and the Fed got concerned about it and were easy trying to get inflation up, not understanding the nature of a big stock bubble. The exact same thing happened as in the 1920s. The only conspiracy I was able to find out was in the 1873 bubble when a brilliant financier, a guy by the name of Jay Cook, got organized and was outstanding at placing U.S. debt during the Civil War. But he was an upstart and, of course, pushed it too far. And Morgan was not pleased, so in the August of 1873, Morgan might have let it known that he wasn't going to help out Jay Cook, who was overextended, got stuck with railroad bonds, and it crashed.
That sparks the thought, the Fisk Gold operations in tandem with the former General Ulysses S. Grant, now in the White House at that period, and their gold market scheme.
The Treasury Secretary couldn't hold back on selling gold, and Grant told him to sell it, but he was able to get word to Fisk ahead of time. So there's where you ended up with buying ostensibly and Fisk, the other side, selling out the whole position.
I'm sure you recall Fisk and Gould's operations on the Erie Railroad against Vanderbilt, the robber baron battles.
What we should be looking for is opportunity in here, and one of them would be the bottoming of this, let's call it forced liquidation. And, Chris, you know, it's really fascinating that through the summer, people were highly confident of the Fed's ability to keep everything going. And then when you get into a price hit in the magnitude of what we have seen so far, what happens is the power shifts over to the margin clerks. And the margin clerk's job description is vastly different to that of a central banker. The central banker's job description has been corrupted to keep the speculation going, i.e., in so many words, to get the accounts offside. And of course, we know the job description of a margin clerk is to get the accounts onside. And in every liquidity crisis, the margin clerk has had more power than the central bank. It's a fascinating world. In 1929, Harrison was chair of the New York Fed, which, like now, is a giant compared to the other Fed chapters. And he exceeded his lending authority by a factor of 6 times in buying bonds out of the market.
Don't discount the New York Fed. I don't know if you know this or not. Very few people are aware that the New York Fed is the only one of the 12 member banks that is always accounted for in the Federal Open Market Committee. In other words, they have a permanent seat. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York is arguably always has been and will be due to the terminology written in to the Federal Reserve Act.
I can tell you another fascinating anecdote about a top of the bubble in 1873 when you had strains appearing in the credit markets and experienced traders and investors could recognize those. But of course, the media were on the bubble and the Herald published in New York editorialized that yes, something could go wrong, but the U.S., saying we, like America, had the Treasury system, and it did not have a central bank constrained by gold. And therefore, the Treasury system could discount unlimited amounts. So it could flood the money market at the first sign of trouble. Now, in England, you also had then the head of the editor at The Economist, Walter Bagehot. And he was highly regarded then, and still highly regarded, despite he published his major book called Lombard Street in 1873, and in it he put down the remedy to prevent contractions, which was to stand in there and the central bank would provide all kinds of liquidity. And that was well known in 1873. So both in the London market, which is the senior market, and New York, which was the junior market, they had the recipe to prevent contraction. And then the contraction came in, and it was very severe in England, which then was the focus point of the world economy. And the senior economists by 1884, now there was a recession and then some relief and then another recession, but in 1884 they looked at its continuation and of weak business and called it the Great Depression. And the Great Depression went to the final business cycle low in 1896 and then began to recover. But in that I had done all the research decades ago, you knew that senior economists in England, as late as 1939, were still analyzing the Great Depression, how it could have been prevented, how it could have been ameliorated, etc., meaning the Great Depression of 1873 to 1896. And then by about 1940, we've got another Great Depression. So, you know, senior economists and interacting with financial markets is a never-ending source of irony, and I love it. But, you know, there's very few places that would write this up about the futility of it all, Chris. And they policymakers, the world now considers that they shape events. They respond to events. And quite shortly here, if this liquidity problem continues, which I think it will, interest rates are going to start going down. The T-bill rate will start going down. The Fed will follow in cutting its administered rate, the zero again.
I really tend to side now with, of course, the Austrian, but also the monetarist view. Milton Friedman really was so many decades ahead of his time. I think he's one of the few who really earned his Nobel Prize. And you're right. I think it should be the mandate of the Federal Reserve, of the central banks, assuming we're going to play ball, and this is the system we have, and we both agree it's a flawed system, I do agree the Fed should not try to either forecast or predict. It really should react to excesses in the market. You might say the monetary tool is a much more responsive tool than the traditional Keynesian fiscal policy. It tends to be slow. Very rarely do the funds wind up in the intended sources when you use fiscal policy, whereas the monetary method, you have to admit, only because the institutions, the financial institutions, played ball and they held on to the massive reserves, $4 trillion that the Fed actually piled into our money center banking balance sheets. They didn't lend those funds. We haven't seen yet this tidal wave of inflation precisely because they held on to those funds. And now we're seeing the unwinding of the entire process that's taking place over the next 10 years. Why don't you leave people an overview of what you see ahead for 2019? Will that be the year where the precious metals finally do catch a safe haven, risk on scenario, the 35 a year bull market in bonds evaporates and U.S. equities lose some favor and we see the commodities continue higher?
To gain, we're going to rely on history, Chris. In a great financial bubble, you take the price of gold and deflate it by the CPI in the senior currency, and the pattern since 1720 is that the real price of gold goes down in a bubble and gold stocks underperform. And the huge peak in the precious metal speculation in 2011, we had that one nailed right down. And because the silver-gold ratio got on the RSI got up to 92, and the only time it had been there before was in January of 1980. So here we go, and I'll explain how gold works in a deflationary environment. And every post-bubble contraction, as I say, in the bubble, the real price of gold has come down. It has come down and is trying to base for the last year. Now, the pattern has been that for the first few years of the contraction, the real price of gold goes up. It improves profit margins for the gold industry, and it starts to make money. And then eventually you will have that the action will trail down into the juniors, and you will have a great speculative market. In the past, these have lasted for 20 years, where the real price of gold has gone up. And, for example, in 1929 crash, Homestake, the premier producer, the stock fell down to 8 1/8 or something like that. But also 1930-31, you could have bought the stock at $9 in that average. And then, and it wasn't until early 1933 when Roosevelt raised the price of gold. So we're looking at $20.67 an ounce price for gold. And in the 1929, Homestake lost money because their costs were up. In 1930, 31, and 32, they made money. Their earnings were up something like 130% to the end of 32. And their stock was up by about that much as well when all of the industrial stocks were in the tank. So there was no change in the nominal price of gold, but the real price went up. And this is where you have your best periods for gold mining have been in the post-bubble deflationary contractions. Now, we also, Chris, I did the deflated price of copper. I was able to get it back to 1830.
Let's pop forward, though, to the post-bubble contraction of 2001.
Chris, there's going to be no inflation in commodities. The price of gold will outperform all commodities so that the gold miners make a lot of money. And it's one of the only industry that you can analyze ahead of time that makes money in the post-bubble deflation. And this is what's going to happen. So this is where we're looking now to re-enter the gold market somewhere over the next 5 or 6 weeks on downward pressure. And and mainly because for the long term, the gold mining side becomes extremely profitable, whether the U.S. is on a gold, or the, I should say, whether the senior currency is on a gold standard or not. There's a probability that the U.S. could go back on a gold, sound money.
See, I feel like I'm coming to the same, or let's say a similar parallel, from a completely different direction. I'm watching the European Central Bank ministers, Bank of Japan, the BOJ, the BOE, central banks. I'm listening to their rhetoric, and what I'm hearing is a chorus of surprisingly hawkish, you know, the U.S. dollar, America, the Fed, our policymakers, I think have kind of had it made, you might say, for the past couple of two or three or even more years. I mean, they've had the luxury of allowing rates to drift higher, the luxury of increasing the benchmark overnight lending rate, while the rest of their colleagues and comrades around the world, for the most part, have kept their hand off of the rudder. But what it looks as though to me now is that the Fed is running out of bullets. They don't have too many more rate hikes, maybe three or four tops next year, and then that rate hike cycle will wrap up. This relative advantage that the U.S. dollar has had over in the Forex market, over the pound, the British pound, over the euro, over the yen, and over the yuan, will be coming to an end, and thus the U.S. dollar, more than likely, it will drift lower and continue perhaps to retest those lows that we saw several years ago. It should be in a sideways to downward trend as we see the quantitative easing operations wrap up around the globe now, as those central bankers play catch-up with the United States. Your thoughts there?
The only reason why these central bankers have been able to expand their portion of the credit is because you've had speculators in financial items. And then when they quit, they seem to be quitting day by day here, then even the most aggressive central banker cannot get its portion of credit out the window. Why do they call it a credit contraction?
I would argue that at least 50% of that argument is due to the fact that we had record low interest rates. So our corporations could issue debt at a record clip with virtually no punishment. They could just sell debt almost for free, as much debt as they wanted. What did they do with that? Well, they filled their balance sheets with their own shares. So they've been buying, they've been buying back and issuing, buying back their equity and filling their balance sheets. Those buybacks are a key component here. So it's not just speculators. Those days are over because rates are going up.
It's, a, as you're pointing out, a great expansion of debt. It's done in a time of rapture and enthusiasm and no risk and all of that stuff. And all you need is a majority of that debt to be due and payable in senior currency units. The senior currency is the U.S. dollar. So once the bubble is over, it looks like it's over, the tide changes and corporate treasurers get interested in paying down debt. I've called it the great debt revulsion. But each, so then they have to sell something in order to, whether they are in Turkey or Egypt or Bolivia, they have to sell something in order to get their hands on a dollar to meet their obligations in New York. So the debt bubble is the biggest, becomes the biggest short on the senior currency in history, which we have. So my net conclusion on it, and I've used the phrase for more than a few years, is that the pattern for the senior currency in a post-bubble contraction is that it is chronically strong against most commodities and most other currencies for most of the time. And the bottom in the U.S. dollar, the DX, it's got slammed in February down to 88, where it became very oversold. And then our work, we needed to have at least a couple of months of building a base. And then it needed to break above the 20-week exponential moving average, which it did at 90.5 on April the 23rd, and it is in a pretty good uptrend. And I think that breaking a right out about, like into the 97 level, the move measures to 103, and if we get into a very severe contraction, it'll go to 120. And this is not so much my imagination, Chris. It's that following every great bubble, the senior currency becomes chronically strong. And you can follow that all the way back to the writings of Thomas Gresham in 1550s. When he was the British agent in the money market in Antwerp. Antwerp. And in his letters to Burleigh, who was the Chancellor of the Exchequer, he explains the problem in bad times of trying to service debt from a weak currency, then sterling, into the guilder, which was then the senior currency and strong. So this is a pretty old evidence trail that in the bad times, the senior currency goes up.
Remember Gresham's law, of course, bad money drives out good. We can draw parallels with your first thought and this thought, and that is that maybe the money that everybody is searching for is the bad money, that the senior currency is actually the riskier place relative to precious metals, but maybe that's a discussion for another day. Why don't you give people your feel, your gut instinct, and what the charts and your analysis are suggesting for U.S. equities, global equities, as well as corporate debt, and perhaps the precious metals, crude oil, and whatnot, the best you can over the next 6 months?
This liquidity problem will probably clear in November, December. Crude oil down until January, dismal lows. Then some rebounds into the first part of the year, and then, say, after March, April, then the next leg of the bear market would come in. It will be an extensive and a serious bear market. On the credit market side, it probably could get bad enough such that the Federal Reserve loses its mandate to be reckless, and it could be curbed quite a bit. I think Trump is very savvy on this. When he first started to knock the Fed, I thought, shouldn't be saying anything about the Fed. But then in the summer when he kept hitting it, and I thought, oh, yeah, and if we go into a contraction in the fall, he's laid the blame on the Fed, which is brilliant for raising interest rates. So folks should be prepared for a post-bubble contraction. As you know, Chris, we've got a whole lot of history on those, and you can get in touch with us. Bob Hoy, just do BobHoy.com. BobHoy.com.
Bob Hoy, Institutional Advisor. We'll talk soon.
Good to talk. Bye-bye.